You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution. Love and
Revolution. This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Buddhist Peace Fellowship co-director Don Haney about spiritual activism, interconnectedness, suffering, impermanence, non-attachment, and how to move off our cushions and into action at a time when deep compassion and powerful change are needed more than ever before.
Well, Buddhist Peace Fellowship really serves as a home for people who are engaging both in Buddhist teachings and radical politics as a way to transform our world and ourselves. Both of these traditions have a lot to say about how we might transform our suffering. And I think for many folks, as we deepen into these practices, we really have been interested to figure out how can we learn from both of these at the same time.
With God stood before you with her hands on her hips.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe Agwanu, hello and welcome. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawn Land today with a heavy heart after having conversation with the Indigenous Elders and Medicine People's Council and government officials and looking at the daunting task that these spiritual leaders have of holding sacred space for us all, providing that container for us to all sit in with our very mixed and tumultuous emotions surrounding the events that are transpiring in the world right now. As we move forward today, I'd like to ask you all to keep those leaders in your prayers. They need our love and support and the benefit of our strength to help them to hold that space right now. We're in for a great treat today with the discussion that we're going to be having, and I will be joined in that discussion by my amazingly loving and wonderful co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Hello, Sherry. And just remember that we're sending you love as well as to the elders and the spiritual leaders and the people at Standing Rock right now, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous. And also we're sending that love to all the people we might put in our mind on the other side of this equation, that they too need that deep compassion, that radical compassion, that kind of real, raw, fierce love that says, as Dr. King said, we're against the injustice. We're not against you as a human being. That's hard. That is hard work, especially with the stuff that we're seeing. To continue to hold that ground is very, very difficult spiritual, emotional, psychological work. And so one of the things that all of us who are providing support roles or solidarity roles for those who are on the front lines or who are deep in the organizing work is to remember that and to lift that up as well. I think this movement at Standing Rock is reminding me more deeply than any other campaign or action that I've been a part of our interconnectedness and how when something like this happens, we are all called to be a part of it in small and large ways and to really maintain our own center, our prayer, and to understand that it's not easy while you're doing that.
I think that, you know, that's really important to recognize that we're all a part of this movement, that the people who are at Standing Rock have been called to awaken from this deep inner call, this call that comes from our attachment to our umbilical cord to Mother Earth. It's really a cry for the protection of life. It's a cry for the survival of life on this planet. And the people who have been answering that call have been led to Standing Rock, and they're joined there by others who haven't yet attuned themselves to that call, but they're responding to the evidence provided by science to let us know that we are in a situation right now where all life is on the line, and everything that we do, whether it's sharing these stories on the airwaves that give us hope, or being on the front lines as activists, building new structures that support a new way of being with one another and with the natural environment, all of these things are critical to the preservation of life going forward. And so we know that our listeners are all listening into that call in one way or another, that they've all been called to rise up in some way to help make this world a more sane and humane place for us to be. And I think that the benefit of us having this space on the airwaves is to lift up a light for those actions that are taking place around the world that give people hope, that give them guidance in a new direction, that help them to listen more clearly for the call that's rising up within them and directing them toward actions and towards ways of being that can help to promote a healing path for us all. And we're all on that path together. I'm on that path. Rivera is on that path. Our guest today is on that path. Our listeners are on that path. And we're on that path with the entire creation. And so one of the things that I found hope in is recognizing the fact that none of us are alone on this path, that even when we are daunted by the things that we are facing, we are still surrounded by all those others who give us life, who give us energy, who give us love and support. And that's incredibly encouraging and incredibly important for us all to remember right now as we're moving into these days of transition, because it's a painful and often messy process, but we are moving toward a new birth, a new way of being. And we have to remember that as we're walking forward, even when we have cause to despair.
I think that's an important part of the metaphor, Sherry, that change is not painless, that when we see all kinds of change happening in our world, whether it's ecosystem change, whether it's being born, whether it's dying, or whether it's healing from a sickness or going through an illness, moving to a new place, losing a job, finding a job, going through a rite of passage or a coming of age, that metamorphosis is about shedding the old and stepping into the new, neither end of that process being particularly easy or painless. Sometimes it's more exciting. But, you know, there's a certain amount of uncomfort, discomfort, pain, challenge, ugliness that comes forth, the raw vulnerability that must happen in the process of change. And learning to look at that is an important part of the process. And that's kind of a good place to start bringing in our guest, Dawn Haney, who has been very patient on the line. And I know she's got lots of thoughts on everything we've been talking about, because Dawn is the co-director of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, which is nearly 40 years old this year. It was established in the late 1970s. She lives in Richmond, California, in the Bay Area, and she is both a spiritual practitioner and an activist, which makes her a very intriguing guest on our show today. And we'll be asking her lots of questions about Buddhism and activism. Welcome to the show, Dawn, and thank you for having this conversation with us today.
Oh, thank you, Sherry and Rivera, for inviting me on.
Dawn, we would love for you to start out today by giving our listeners an overview of the work that you do. How does it all come together? What is it founded in? And how do you see it benefiting all of us moving forward?
Sure. Well, Buddhist Peace Fellowship really serves as a home for people who are engaging both in Buddhist teachings and radical politics as a way to transform our world and ourselves. And I think for me at least, you know, I came to both Buddhist practice and politics because of my personal experiences with suffering growing up. And both of these traditions have a lot to say about how we might transform our suffering. And I think for many folks, as we deepen into these practices, we really have been interested to figure out how can we learn from both of these at the same time. And so folks who are part of Buddhist Peace Fellowship draw actually from a lot of different traditions. Buddhism has a number of different spiritual lineages from different parts of Asia that have then traveled to other parts of the world, Europe, the US, and beyond. And so BPFers kind of pull from those multiple lineages, whether that's like Japanese Zen Buddhism. I practice more in the Theravada lineages that come out of Thailand, Sri Lanka, and Burma. Other folks are more connected with Tibetan Buddhism and beyond. And we also draw from a number of different political traditions. And I think especially over the last 5 years since I've been part of Buddhist Peace Fellowship, we've really tried to center our work in more radical political traditions. So, you know, that's traditions like women of color feminism, it's really strong critiques of capitalism, authoritarianism, drawing on queer and trans liberation, disability justice, and trying to find a way to pull those threads together alongside various Buddhist traditions to see sort of like how all of those traditions that focus on change might inform each other and really work towards transforming both ourselves, what's happening on the inside while we're working on transforming what's happening in our world.
Don, for any of our listeners who are not steeped in Buddhism, can we give them a Buddhism 101 as it pertains to and relates to change or activism or the process of making transformation occur in our world?
Sure. So one of the Buddha's core teachings that some folks are familiar with are what are called the Four Noble Truths, where the Buddha talks about suffering and the end of suffering. So the Four Noble Truths start off, and sometimes Buddhism gets a bad rap of being like, it's only focused on suffering, which is not true. But the Buddha just is saying like, hey, there is suffering in the world. Let's not pretend it's not there, but let's actually attend to it and engage with it. So that first truth just points to the fact that there is suffering. The second noble truth tries to look and understand the causes of suffering. How does suffering come to be? With the Buddha really pointing to the ways that we cling to how we want things to be or how we don't want them to be as a deep cause of suffering. The third truth is sort of a turn towards the promise that there's actually the possibility of the end of suffering. And then the fourth is a path of 8 ways to practice towards actually ending suffering for ourselves and for the world. So that's a bit of a primer on what the Buddha has to say about suffering. And I think for me, how it applies politically, one, I think it's helpful, you know, so much of our world today, we are taught to really try to avoid suffering. And certainly consumerism is all about trying to buy things so that we can not suffer too much and be as comfortable as possible. So instead of sort of attuning to try to grasp and draw in all kinds of things that might eliminate our suffering, actually taking the time to attend towards what suffering looks like politically in our planet. So certainly right now, bringing greater attention towards North Dakota and the indigenous folks on the front lines trying to stop the pipeline is one way to sort of start to attend towards suffering. Then looking at, you know, what are the causes of that? And certainly in this case, our nation's obsession with oil and the comfort of driving our own cars around and making all sorts of things is part of what shapes our attachment to actually what causes greater suffering. You know, third, that we can change things. Certainly I've been incredibly inspired by the folks who are on the front lines, who are really teaching us all a lot about the importance of bringing together spiritual work and activist work and really seeing the work of stopping the pipeline not just about the climate and about our water, but also about rebuilding the capacity and the connections among Indigenous people to connect and fight for their own rights and their own land, I think is such an important part of this movement as well, and really drawing on spiritual traditions to be able to have kind of the stamina and the patience and the kindness and the energy, those kinds of qualities that we also are practicing in Buddhist traditions as well, to be able to stay the course for this kind of action, which is long and hard and challenging.
One of the things that I hear quite frequently from different people that I speak to, both from within the Buddhist tradition and outside the Buddhist tradition, is that there are some people who see the Buddhist practice as a passive acceptance of what is. Mm-hmm. So can you talk to us a little bit about how this translates into actively making the world a better place? And how do you translate your Buddhist practice into meaningful activism?
Well, I think as Buddhism has come to the U.S. in particular and has been picked up in the mainstream, not sort of fully as Buddhism, but particularly just picked up as mindfulness and meditation practice, it's sort of shed many of the spiritual tradition, like the actual spiritual tradition, into, hey, if you just are able to be mindful and meditate, you can put up with your crappy job or your relationship or electoral politics or whatever it is that folks might be drawn to just kind of passively accept. And so I think that's why it's important, you know, that we're the Buddhist Peace Fellowship and that we actually are pretty engaged with trying to bring other parts of Buddhism, not necessarily into the mainstream, but into this work that we're doing as spiritual activists. So the Buddha actually teaches a lot about ethics and about the role, you know, that meditation is actually just one of the many of the 8 steps towards liberation from suffering. And so there's actually 7 other parts that many folks have abandoned. So a key one that we talk about a lot is right action. And what are the, you know, how is it that we act in the world as a way to be more grounded in the spiritual tradition? And so the core of that action is really around non-harming, which in our day-to-day life might look like not killing other people, but also not killing animals or bugs. But in a political sense, is also around interrupting and stopping harm from happening. So we've been really training ourselves and other folks in nonviolent direct action as a tool to be able to actually interrupt and stop harm from happening, as a way that one way that we have been translating this sort of broader set of Buddhist practices into actual political action.
I think this is a question that Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist monk, also confronted when he made the choice with the young monks of Vietnam and during the Vietnam War to come down out of the mountains and to start the practices of engaged Buddhism. It was a radical act for his time, for the Society of Buddhism that was happening in Vietnam at the time. But it's a very parallel story and choice to what you're describing, that there's a belief that you can just sit on the cushion and you can eliminate the delusion or the illusion of all the suffering and pains in the world and meditate your way into nirvana. And yeah, I chuckle too at that. Because one of the things that is kind of like the catch-22 of Buddhism always makes me smile is the whole notion of interconnectedness, where one of the very core principles is understanding the interconnected web that is us all, and that wherever there is suffering, there is ourself as well. And, you know, we could get into a long discourse on the self. That's very much a part of Buddhism. But just to back off from that part of it for a moment and discuss the interconnected web, I'd really love to discuss, why is the concept of interconnectedness so important to the Buddhist understanding and philosophy? And how does that relate to the choice to take action to end injustice and suffering in our world?
Well, I do think it I appreciate you bringing in Thich Nhat Hanh, who's such a core founder of some of the kinds of work that Buddhist Peace Fellowship has been up to over the past 40 years. And I appreciate his framing of interconnectedness or interbeing as sort of the flip side of how the Buddha talks about the self and our clinging to our sense of self as a core reason that we suffer. I'm thinking particularly about an action that I participated in a couple of years ago in late 2014, was a couple of weeks after Darren Wilson, the police officer who killed Michael Brown in Ferguson, was released from all charges, and folks were really upset and frustrated and participated in a direct action that shut down the Oakland Police Department for 4.5 hours and created space, particularly for Black folks in the Oakland community, to speak out against the police department, which, for folks not from around Oakland, Oakland has some of the most deeply racist and violent tradition of policing in Black and Brown communities for many years. And there was a way, actually, in participating in that direct action, and one of my role was actually to be locked together with other people to block an intersection from cars being able to go through. And, you know, it's the kind of role that, like, there's no way that I could do that on my own. It wouldn't actually be possible. I'm not a large enough body to block a 4-lane road by myself. And so it actually required me to be literally interconnected with other beings chained together into a line to be able to serve this role and to create then the space behind us in the roadway for Black folks in particular to be able to speak out against the police. And so there was this, you know, it's where for me, like, actually being able to participate in political action is a way to actually experience interconnectedness on a deep cellular level. Our group of people was just one of many groups. Some folks were chained to close the doors. Other folks, there was one group of people that raised a flag on the flagpole that had hand-painted portraits of several folks who had been killed by police at that time, many more since then. But it was actually sort of in that line for myself, more so than sitting on a cushion or sitting off in a cave somewhere, that I could actually experience where my life fits in to a much larger sense of community and sense of connectedness, because it was through our connection and through our power that we could actually stop traffic from happening and create this particular moment. So I really invite folks who are kind of unsure about whether political action can support spiritual practice to try it out. Because I actually think especially with that intention, there's so many ways that participating in political action, and especially direct action, can really help us cultivate in a different way these qualities and can help us understand these truths that are part of Buddhism.
Dawn, when I was reading your website, one of the things that is on there is this triple treasure of compassionate action, learning, speaking, mm-hmm. and doing. Mm-hmm. And the doing piece is part of the mandala of social change, which I love, which is acting in collaboration with other organizations and individuals to cultivate the conditions for peace. Can you give us some examples of the collaborations that you've been involved with and the type of organizations that you've and individuals that you've worked with to actually put this into action? What types of things have you done and who have you done them with?
We've been in a bit of what we've called our radical rebirth over the past 5 years. And so we've really been trying to figure out, like, in this new age where, you know, BPF started 40 years ago, where social movements of that time were the anti-Vietnam War movement and some of the free speech movement were some of the movements that BPF was grounded in. And in this day and age, you know, we're really trying to support folks in a few years ago connecting with the Occupy movement and now movements like Black Lives Matter, and actually have some folks right now who are in North Dakota to help with stopping the pipeline. And so in kind of shifting what movements we're thinking about connecting folks to, we've in some ways had to start building again from the ground up who we're collaborating with and what that looks like. So a huge piece of what we've been doing is really recentering our community in younger folks of color, queer and trans folks in particular, as sort of the people that we are trying to build and connect together to do action. And since we are a national organization, we are sometimes doing that here locally in the San Francisco Bay Area and supporting some work as well in New York, DC, New Orleans, and outside of Detroit with different Dharma communities, but have also been trying to find ways to build relationships between folks of color from all over who have this deep interest in Buddhist teachings and radical politics. So earlier this year, for the first time, we held our Block Build B retreat, where about 35 folks came from all over, really to strengthen relationships and to see what collaborations might emerge from that crew of folks. One that's happening right now is that a good chunk of that group is figuring out capacity to go support Standing Rock in some ways, potentially supporting direct action, helping out with medic support, as well as, you know, just general labor that's needed as folks prepare for winter there. And I think more broadly, we, you know, have been continuing to support different Dharma centers, especially those who are interested in learning more about direct action. So we also have a 2-day training that we have done in various places to really tie together some Buddhist teachings and nonviolent direct action principles to support folks in engaging in whatever movements are happening locally in their communities.
Dawn, can we speak a little bit about non-attachment or non-grasping as it pertains to both the change that, say, we need to look at happening in the United States? We could look globally, but the United States is a good test subject. and also in terms of non-attachment to outcomes as we move into action. Those are kind of like two views or two perspectives on the idea of non-grasping or non-attachment, which is a central tenet of Buddhist philosophy. And I was wondering if you would speak a little bit about that.
I will. For me, at least, like, it's important to remember that non-attachment to outcomes doesn't mean that you should never have a goal. And I think one of actually the ways that has helped me to think to practice with this at this intersection of between Buddhism and political action is to think about a lot of what we do in an experimental model. So anything that we might try, you know, we'd set out a goal, we'd have a hypothesis about how we think things are going to play out, but then we learn from it and we might be wrong. What we think might be really effective might actually not be effective at all. And then we switch gears and try something else out. And I think that to me is part of the loosening attachment to outcome, is to stay curious, to stay open to what might emerge, to know that we actually, no one of us has like a big enough view to know for sure how things are going to turn out. And that feels actually like it creates a lot more space to just sort of like step into the work and engage in it without kind of knowing how it's going to turn out. But it's certainly not easy, I think, especially when we're doing work that affects us and our communities really directly. And that when the change feels like it needs to happen like 500 years ago, not even yesterday, but like a long time ago, this needs to be different. So it's holding on to that paradox, which I think is a lot of what Buddhist practice has supported me in doing, holding on to these kinds of paradox between, as we say, like accepting things as they are and fighting like hell to change them. Like both of those need to be held at the same time, and even if when they feel completely in paradox.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence.
Right now, I need you to be love, 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 love.
On this week's Nonviolence Minute, we're going to talk about the fears that have come up with the recent presidential election of Donald Trump. Many people are deeply concerned about his policies and his racist, sexist rhetoric, along with the violent and discriminatory actions of his supporters that we are already seeing happen on our streets. Many people see Donald Trump as Hitler minus the mustache, but while we're dusting off the ghosts of Nazi Germany, remember that history not only holds stories of horrors and atrocities, but also stories of courage, heroism, and resistance. Those of us who choose nonviolent action as a form of making change are often challenged with the question, well, what about the Nazis? Well, it's important to remember the analysis of scholar Gene Sharp, who pointed out that while widespread nonviolent struggle was never attempted against the Nazis, wherever it was used, it was quite successful. Therefore, on this week's Nonviolence Minute, we're going to share 5 stories of nonviolent resistance to the Nazis. The White Rose was a resistance group of German students who opposed Hitler's supremacist agenda and his imperialistic wars. At a time when dissent was punishable by execution, these 18 to 22-year-olds wrote leaflets and distributed thousands of them throughout Germany in total secrecy. When they were discovered, they were executed. The point of the story is not their deaths, but rather their lives and the example they offer to us. If a group of children can risk death to speak truth, we too can take action to speak out. Our next story occurs in France. When the Nazis invaded and occupied, André Trocmé and his wife Magda worked with the villagers and parishioners of the tiny mountain town of La Chambon-sur-Lignon to create a series of safe houses for fleeing Jews. The local schools enrolled children under false names and met them at the train station as if welcoming family members into their homes. When asked to produce a list of Jews, Trocmé replied, "We do not know what a Jew is. We only know men." It is estimated that the village saved the lives of 3,500 Jewish refugees. Their lesson to us in this time, when millions of people are being threatened with deportation, is to find ways to protect the dignity and safety of fellow human beings, and also to challenge the discrimination by speaking up for and asserting our common humanity with one another. Danish resistance to Nazi occupation contains many chapters, each with dazzling tactics and creative solutions. But there is none more jaw-dropping, however, than the Danish people's rescue of 7,220 of their total 7,800 Jews. On September 28, 1943, Nazi occupation forces intended to arrest the entire Jewish population of Denmark and transport them to concentration camps. Word of the plan leaked, however, and thousands of Danes rallied to hide the Jews in their homes. Fishermen ferried the Jews across the ocean to nearby Sweden, saving all but a few hundred people. In addition to the obvious lessons from this story, it is important to note that this remarkable resistance hinged upon the actions of one whistleblower in the occupation government. Many people in our country may find themselves in similar positions, and the question we all must put to ourselves is, will we have the courage to do what is right? My hope and prayer is that our answer is a resounding yes. Our fourth story of resistance comes from Rosenstrauss in Berlin. A group of white German women's Jewish husbands had been rounded up and were scheduled to be sent to the concentration camps. The women gathered en masse outside the building and refused to leave until their husbands were released. After several violent attempts to disperse the women, they succeeded in getting the release of their husbands. The lesson from this story, however, is bittersweet. For while the women saved the ones closest to their hearts, we also know that millions more died. Therefore, we in our time must learn both the power of determined nonviolent action and also the crucial lesson of standing up for the rights, lives, dignity, and safety of all others, not just those closest to us. We must also act now, not when it is too late. The last story we'll share in our Nonviolence Minute today is the Norwegian teacher's defense of education. Pro-Nazi collaborators ordered a fascist educational curriculum to be taught in the schools. When 8,000 to 10,000 of Norway's 12,000 teachers refused to cooperate, the occupation government panicked and closed the schools. 200,000 parents wrote letters of protest to the government. The government responded by ordering the arrest of 1,000 teachers and sending 500 of them to a prison camp in the Arctic. As trainloads of teachers were shipped north, students and families gathered along the tracks, singing and offering food to the teachers as they passed. On November 4, 1942, after months of teacher strikes and resistance actions, the occupation government released all the teachers and abandoned their earlier plans. The Norwegians had defended their youth from being subjected to fascist curriculum, and their lesson to us is that the ideologies of hate can be resisted by collective actions of our society. We can organize to insist that respect, understanding, and human and civil rights be promoted in the educational and cultural arenas of our country. Know your history, my friends, for when history repeats, those of us who do not know the stories of nonviolent resistance may see ourselves witnessing the horrors of genocide, war, and violence. Those who know their nonviolent history, however, will glean from the stories the wisdom, inspiration, and ideas for practical action that can empower us to end fear, hatred, bigotry, and violence. In today's times, more than ever, knowing our nonviolent history will certainly change our lives. And now, let's return to speaking with Dawn Haney.
One of the other things that I think is a really interesting topic of discussion is this intersection between attachment, detachment, and interconnectedness. Mm-hmm. So when we start looking at all of these connections, when we start understanding that all life is tied together, that we are actually part of one living system,
yeah,
and that our choices, our thoughts, our actions, our words, all of these things join together with this larger energy field that is fueling the planet to create the reality that we're a part of. So when we start thinking about detachment in relation to understanding our responsibilities within this interconnected sphere of creation, how do you reconcile the seeming difference between those two concepts, detachment and understanding interconnectedness? So this is a conversation that I've had with a few of my friends over the years, and I always find it interesting to see how people meet this intersection. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Sure. What it brings up for me is one of my favorite teachings, which came through Jack Kornfield, who was a student of Ajahn Chah, who's one of the Thai forest masters in the Theravada Buddhist lineage. And Jack Kornfield was a monk there for many years, learning from Ajahn Chah before coming back to the U.S. and founding Bear Rock Meditation Center here in Northern California. And as he watched Ajahn Chah's teachings, he would see Ajahn Chah say one thing to one person, and then the next day someone would ask the same question, and he would basically give them the opposite answer. And Jack was like, at some point, got really frustrated and asked Ajahn Chah, "What are you doing? Like, you're giving people like completely different answers. I don't understand what you're teaching." And Ajahn Chah said his role as a spiritual teacher was to direct people down a road that he could see more clearly than they could, as someone who was a pretty intense spiritual master. And so some folks were kind of veering into the ditch on the right. And so he would tell them, "Hey, you got to go left." And other folks were veering into the ditch on the left. And he would say, "Hey, wait a minute, you need to go right." And so even though go left versus go right are totally opposite instructions, they both were supporting people and getting back on the path. So I share that story and thinking about like attachment versus detachment versus interconnectedness, because for me, I try to track what's sort of my personal tendency, like is my personal tendency to be more comfortable in hanging out in detachment, which sometimes is true or in certain conditions is true. And in that case, it feels like for my spiritual development, leaning more into attachment or interconnectedness and really stepping into that is actually what will support my growth Whereas for other folks who maybe are like overly feeling attached to things, creating a little bit more space is helpful. And I feel like I learned a lot of that before I was at Buddhist Peace Fellowship. I worked in the anti-sexual violence movement for many years, working on a crisis hotline where folks were coming to us with pretty intense experiences of being harmed through sexual violence. And so, you know, we often talked about kind of watching our tendencies there, either towards getting pretty overwhelmed with what people were sharing and wanting to kind of detach and be disconnected from it, versus other times feeling really overwhelmed also, but wanting to try to fix everything for someone. And so trying to find that balance between too much attachment and too much detachment as a way to stay kind of in greater balance with our relationship with each other, to me it's kind of just like a constant balancing act, which is part of staying engaged and staying attuned to, like, how do I stay in that place of interconnectedness that's not sort of too boundarylessness, without boundaries of the individual, but also not too detached and separate. And I do think, in my experience, a lot of folks are drawn to Buddhism because they have a certain level of comfort in a more detached setting. And so I think a lot of our work at BPF is to nudge people out of that comfort zone and towards greater connection and connectedness.
One of the things that intrigues me about the whole notion of attachment, detachment, and the interconnected web or interconnectedness is that attachments, like, I don't mean in just the Buddhist sense, but in the biological sense, the network sense, there are these points of connection that are weaving together. Like if we think of synapses in the brain, they're attaching, they're forming, and they're unforming at the same time. And because of the forming and the unforming, we can have an interconnected web that changes, that is impermanent, that does evolve, change, or transform. If we had no capacity to have a moment of release, of detachment, of letting go, all of those things, then we could have no change in a new direction either. So for me, that's an interesting dimension of the whole conversation, is that this is part of the fabric of reality, this fabric that is constantly being woven. And then there's all the different kinds of levels of consciousness of how do we deal with that? How do we live as part of and within this ever-changing interconnected web of being and existence that we apparently are? And that's kind of like a huge metaphysical question. And I have a very actually straightforward spiritual activism question, which is Buddhist Peace Fellowship works with a slogan, Block, Build, Be, three different modes of working or embodying a process of change. And I would love to know more about that.
It really draws on some work that Joanna Macy, who's another of our spiritual activist elders, has done for many years, where, you know, there's these three modes. So one is blocking harm, like interrupting injustice, oppression that's happening. You know, that work has to happen immediately. And so there's a lot of activist work in that sense. A second is around build, which is often building the kinds of inspiring alternatives that we actually want to be living in, not just focusing on stopping harm, but also building community, building urban farms, building educational systems that actually teach and support students is another realm of activism that a lot of folks are engaged in. And then the B part is really around cultivating this spiritual transformation and doing some of this like neuron rewiring work for ourselves, but also as a way to help reshape how we relate to each other in community. So examples-wise, you know, we've talked a lot about interrupting the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota, as on the surface, it looks most clearly like stopping harm from happening. But I think one of the reasons it's been really inspiring to us is that it's also so much about building community and building connections that have been broken and building the kinds of connections that we want to see in our future world, and that it really, as well on the B side, actually really cultivates the kind of spiritual transformation that we all need, this sort of loosening our attachments to capitalism, white supremacy, patriarchy, as part of this work. At BPF, we've also been working some on another aspect of build in this realm. So in the Bay Area, especially East Bay, Oakland, Berkeley areas, is Ohlone land. And a group of Ohlone folks have come together to build a land trust, the Segurite Land Trust, to invite settlers who live here in the Bay Area to actually pay a tax yearly in order to support folks being able to rebuy land and to rebuild community here in the Bay Area for folks whose land had been taken from them. So we've been, you know, it feels like part of the build work is really trying to connect Buddhists and different meditation centers to pay their taxes, to be in more right relationship with the Ohlone folks who still live here and who are fighting hard to be able to have land so that they can stay here and continue to be supported. So it's an example of like a different kind of build work that we do as well. And then I think often in the B, in addition to maybe more directly obvious like spiritual practice, you know, I think we also are trying to do greater political education for ourselves and others. And we haven't started yet, but have been talking about picking up study of the Standing Rock curriculum that was put out a few weeks ago and kind of be in greater conversation about our histories as settlers to this land, some whose ancestors came here by choice, some not. Feels like a political component of the B of really trying to understand and reshape our relationships to each other.
One of the things that strikes me as you're talking about those things is that, you know, we're not separated from the land. When I talk about who I am as a Bunawabskek, as Skijinawi Apwid, a native woman from Bunawabskek, when I talk about who I am and where I come from, I answer that with one word. Because the land is Bunawabskek, the water is Bunawabskek, and the people are Bunawabskek. You know, we're all the same. We're all interconnected. So yeah. When we stand up and we make these stands for the land that people are connected to, it goes much deeper than a piece of property as it's understood under Western law. Yeah. That what we're really talking about is a fundamental laws of creation. What we're talking about are the laws of the universe, something that's much, much deeper than the understanding that most people have. And that requires for many people around the world a dramatic retraining of their mind, a dramatic retraining in the way that they see themselves in correlation to the rest of creation. And so are there precepts within your teaching that address that connectivity to the rest of life, that we really are all deeply connected to one another, to the earth? You know, when I heard the stories of the Buddhist monks who were building a house and they were digging a hole for the foundation and they dug it with spoons so that they could move all of the worms that were there without harming them and other living beings that were making their home in the soil and move them to a safe place. And so, you know, that kind of mindfulness is one thing, but understanding that you are that earth and you are that worm and you are all of those other living beings that are making their home within this ecosystem that you share is a whole other way of viewing it. And I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are on understanding that oneness with the rest of creation.
Mm-hmm. If folks haven't read Thich Nhat Hanh's version of either the 5 mindfulness trainings, or he has an expanded version of the 14 mindfulness trainings, I feel like those are some of the most beautiful teachings that really dig into this sense of interconnection of, you know, so they're sort of built around these precepts that I mentioned earlier around not harming, not stealing, not harming through sexual misconduct, not lying, and being mindful of the use of intoxicants. And I think especially the instructions or the guidelines around not stealing feel important to look at, as you're pointing to, like in the idea that anyone can own any part of the land and not be grasping onto it for their own sense of self, rather than really appreciating how it fits into a much larger ecosystem that must be, it like doesn't actually make any sense when it's not connected. I'm scanning his mindfulness training to see if there's a piece that would sort of speak to this, but he says, "I'm determined not to steal and not possess anything that should belong to others." But I think I would love to see that extended even more around reshaping our sense of ownership of land and of the world. So certainly as we move towards ownership of water, which Nestle is trying to be up to, and other things, I think folks can really feel the ways that ownership actually feels out of alignment with how the world really works and how it really needs to work to be able to support not just us, but other living beings on the planet.
Dawn, this is such an interesting conversation to have unfold in today's show, because one of the things I did as a novelist was I wrote a book called Billionaire Buddha, which really took the story of a man, based on true story, who was in the 1% and decided to give all his money away. And it was an intense, rigorous meditation of sorts on this very question, because ultimately at the end of the book, he realizes that you cannot have ownership and really deeply follow the understandings that the Buddha laid forth. That's my own perspective on it. How can we own another being, another person, a piece of land, another animal? That this is actually quite in violation of the basic nature of what we are. We can live in relationship with one another, and we must live in relationship with one another. But the ownership thing is a delusion, I feel, that we have picked up over time as humanity. And as Sherry is calling us to remember, that it is perhaps something we should deeply consider putting down. Not that that is an easy path in today's modern world, which is very much addicted to, talk about an attachment, the notions of property and ownership.
Yeah, and I think I'm also thinking about, you know, in Buddhist tradition, we have both the lay community, folks like me who are practicing Buddhism, but still kind of pretty engaged in day-to-day living, as most folks are. But then we also have the monastic community, folks who have, you know, the place where folks really have given up worldly possessions. In many of the monastic tradition, monks and nuns can't even store food for 24 hours, that they must sort of continually just be asking for support to be fed by their communities and sort of not even owning food for any length of time. So I think there's in thinking not just about not owning stuff, it's like, oh, not even maintaining ownership of sustenance is a pretty deep spiritual practice.
I'd like to remind our listeners that we are speaking with Dawn Haney of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship and having a very engaging discussion on a number of issues that are not only pertinent to us as individuals, but also pertinent to us in a larger scale as a global family. And one of the things that you've been talking about, Dawn, is this idea, Ewan Rivera, this idea of addiction. Addiction to ideas of ownership, addiction to fossil fuels, addiction to capitalist consumption. We have all of these addictive behaviors that we've developed over time that are all based in illusion. So as we get ready to close out the show, what suggestions do you have for our listeners that might guide them out of this pathway of addiction?
Well, I think, again, having some familiarity with 12-step work myself and actually having some introduction to Buddhism through 12-step teachings and trying to search for a power greater than myself that I felt like I could rely on and lean on. I do think it's where spiritual traditions, whatever spiritual traditions folks feel grounded in or drawn to, can really help provide the kind of larger container to hold life and to hold just how much suffering exists in life for us. And that for me has been one of the reasons that Buddhist practice has been incredibly helpful in being able to hold anger, shame, guilt, fear, and to hold those on alongside more qualities of joy and kindness and compassion and balance as well. So, you know, I think that's a piece, and I know for many folks who've been harmed by various spiritual traditions, that's not necessarily an easy invitation. And so, you know, it's where I do appreciate the, you know, whatever it is that really supports you in being connected with something much larger, whether it's getting out into nature, whether it's being in community and really feeling the ways that our work together has so much more power than what we can do on our own. You know, I think that having that connection to something much larger for me has been what helps loosen my own sense of addictions to, as you're pointing to, much beyond like drugs and alcohol or other things that we think about being addicted to, but also my addictions to consumerism or other ways that we relate to the world that really are going to need to shift if we want to see things change and want to see this planet survive.
Dawn, thank you for sharing that. If people want to reach out to Buddhist Peace Fellowship and connect with the work that you're doing for themselves or for the group near them, how would they get a hold of you?
Yeah, well, best place is to check us out online at BPF for Buddhist Peace Fellowship.org. You can also look us up on Facebook, and we connect pretty closely with members through our e-newsletter that comes out 2 to 4 times a month. So that's a place if you're definitely interested to stay connected.
Thank you so much, Dawn. It's been a pleasure having you on the show with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been great to talk with you all.
Thanks this week to our guest, Dawn Haney, and thanks to my co-host, Sherry Mitchell, whom I love and respect and appreciate this time together every week. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find her music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And I'd like to thank my beautiful co-host, Rivera-san, for holding this vital space with me, for all of you, and for the planet right now. It's really critical, the work that we're doing. So if you enjoyed the things that I shared on the show, then you may also enjoy the things that I post on my Facebook page, Sacred Instructions, which can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program that can be broadcast in your local area. All you have to do is call your local station and ask them to put it on. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera-san's website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
And for Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera-san. Our guest today, Dawn Haney from the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, mentioned 3 ways that Buddhists nationwide are engaging with the process of making change. You all heard her describe them on the show, listeners, so hopefully you're going away from today's episode of Love and Revolution Radio thinking about how you can block, build, or be by the time we talk to you next week.